This is a scenario in which you really don't want to use PEEP. It could be disastrous.
This, in essence, gets out of the comfort zone of many emergency physicians.
This is a great logical approach to the hypoxic patient.
You can't get their saturations up or improve their oxygenation.
Even though it's called mild, it has a 27% mortality associated with it.
Once again, the utility of ultrasound. Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland in Baltimore, Maryland, joined by three outstanding stellar co-hosts, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Peter W., and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. Peter, how goes it this month?
It goes much better. We had a little bit of a hurricane scare last week, but now it's a cool breath of fresh air and fall-like weather in New Orleans.
That sounds amazing. Rob, how about you on the West Coast?
Been pretty rough in Northern California. I'm sure you've heard of the fires, and we had quite a bit of smoke that drifted down our way all the way through the Bay Area, and even had to have some school-free days and days when people were warned about going outside. So it's been pretty hot and pretty worrisome out here.
Yeah, looking at just a little bit or minimal of the news coverage, certainly devastating with all the wildfires and really the loss of life. It's sad to hear.
Yeah, it is. It's really very tragic. This disaster apparently didn't really seem to garner as much national attention as I suppose some of the hurricanes did, but it really has been devastating. There have been a lot of deaths and a lot of property damage, and just people are on edge out here.
Well, certainly our thoughts are with everyone who is not only recovering from the hurricane, natural disasters, but also these fires in Northern California, hoping that things settle down and hopefully get back to normal in the coming weeks and months for many of them. John, how about things up in Philly?
Well, Mike, I have to say, I just got back from a wonderful trip down to Baltimore, where I was able to speak at the Crashing Patient Conference. It was an absolutely phenomenal event. Great turnout for the cardiology pre-conference session, where we had a lot of great discussion about pulmonary hypertension, cardiogenic shock, and a few other things. And then from what I understand was the biggest turnout for the main day that you guys have had so far. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. But the Crashing Patient was a conference that Alma Matu runs in Baltimore, in an annual fall conference. And this is the seventh one. And yep, the attendance was great. Probably record attendance, I can confirm, for this particular conference. And we got a chance to talk about a lot of things in terms of resuscitation, a lot of risk management included in this conference. And during some of the pre-conference discussion and even during the main conference, started to talk a little bit about just the crashing or critically ill patient. And that leads us really into today's topic. And it has to deal with someone who is essentially hanging out in the ED, dare I say an ICU boarder, but in the past few weeks, we've been encountering some struggles actually in our own emergency department with the duration of critically ill patients, specifically the duration of vented patients. And we've had two cases thus far in the past several weeks where patients have been waiting admission to the ICU. They've been vented for acute respiratory failure, various etiologies. But then the patient has gotten into trouble with worsening oxygen saturations. In fact, progressive hypoxemia. And this, in essence, gets out of the comfort zone of many emergency physicians who are listening to this podcast. And we wanted to talk about what to do in the patient who is extremely hypoxic or hypoxemic, and you can't get their saturations up or improve their oxygenation with the traditional ventilator settings that you're used to using. Now, there's some recent literature that we can touch on. But Rob, you brought this really to our attention as well, based upon some cases that you've had also in your ED and ICU. And maybe you can start off by telling us specifically what those were and kind of lead into the discussion on what do we do with these patients?
Yeah, Mike, I had back-to-back patients. One patient who was a 60-year-old gentleman, he was a cirrhotic, who presented with really classic sepsis picture and multilobar pneumonia on chest x-ray. He had patchy infiltrates throughout both lung fields, and we intubated him. We had him on 100% oxygen. And even after that, we're having difficulty maintaining his sat above 90%. And within an hour or two, we had a patient next to him who was a elderly woman in her 70s who basically presented with shock, and we resuscitated her. It also appeared to be septic shock, but not of pulmonary etiology. Her initial chest x-ray was clear, but she was in a shock state, and we resuscitated her and intubated her, and she started developing an ARDS-type picture with diffuse pulmonary infiltrates, diffuse interstitial pulmonary infiltrates. We also had her on 100% oxygen, and we're having difficulties maintaining her oxygen saturation. And wanted to really emphasize that the approaches should be different with these two types of patients, and that we've talked about in the past that you can't use a one-size-fits-all ventilator and oxygenation and ventilation strategy in patients. So it's important to discuss the differences between these types of patients and your approach to trying to maintain oxygenation. And we used two different strategies in these two patients. So I thought this would be a great topic to discuss.
Absolutely. And these are very, very challenging patients. And I think many of our listeners can immediately think of patients in the last year alone that they've had these cases where they've been unable to improve oxygen saturations. Well, I guess before we jump into the specific how to treat these patients, John, let me turn to you. Let's get us all on the same page on what we're talking about. I know many of our listeners are familiar with P to F ratios, but really, what does that mean and what does it portray or portend out to in terms of mortality? Why is it important to know just a few numbers?
Sure, Mike. So the P to F ratio is a short way of saying the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio. And what that means is the partial pressure of arterial oxygen relative to the fraction of inspired oxygen that the patient's breathing. And it's usually used, or the way we talk about it often, is to risk stratify a patient with ARDS. So classically, and based on the Berlin definitions, the PF ratio of mild ARDS is somewhere between 200 and 300. But along with that comes a pretty significant mortality. Even though it's called mild, it has a 27% mortality associated with it. Now, move that a little bit to a lower PF ratio of moderate ARDS, where the PF ratio is closer to somewhere between 100 and 200, and the mortality increases to 32%. Now, the highest risk group has a mortality of 45%, and in some places, maybe even higher, and that's a PF ratio of less than 100, and that's considered severe ARDS. So the idea is that you can kind of gauge how much the patient is oxygenating relative to how much support they're receiving. However, there are some pitfalls, and there's definitely some controversy with these PF ratios because they often don't take into account a normalized PEEP strategy. And so a patient who's on higher PEEP, remember there's two variables that can affect oxygenation in the mechanically ventilated patient. One of them being PEEP, the other one FiO2. Can often vary between different patients or treatment strategies. So sometimes people will argue that that skews the data in terms of the mortality associated PF ratios.
Great, great start. And these are very, very high mortality numbers in terms of 27 to 45% significant morbidity and mortality. Peter, is there a way that you think about hypoxemia, you know, in terms of what's causing it? So the patients in front of us, we can see their saturations are low 80s despite maximal support that we're trying to give, whether it be FiO2 or PEEP or some combination thereof. In your mind, is there a way that you classify these mechanisms or what's going on with the patient?
Sure, Mike. I think when we look at the hypoxic patient, we want to keep in mind kind of five etiologies for this or five mechanisms. The first two are less likely to occur, but they're worth discussing, and that is a low FiO2, and usually we're controlling this in the ED of the ICU, and the other is hypoventilation. So with hypoventilation, as the PCO2 rises, it has to shove down the partial pressure of oxygen, and that can cause some hypoxemia or relative hypoxemia. But those are kind of on the rare side. We usually control for those variables. The three that are most common are VQ mismatch, so ventilation perfusion mismatching, a right to left shunt, and then diffusion impairment. And those are the three that are the big players. Again, VQ mismatch, right to left shunt, and diffusion impairment. All three of those are characterized by a widened AA gradient and an abnormal PaO2 to FiO2 ratio, your P to F ratio that was discussed before.
All right. Outstanding. Well, Rob, let's take into context what we've just talked about in terms of numbers and the primary etiologies or mechanisms with VQ mismatch, shunt, and diffusion impairment. And let's actually treat these patients. So start us off with, in the context of the two patients you presented, how do we go about thinking about and then subsequently really making ventilator adjustments? What do we do to improve oxygenation in these critically ill folks?
Yeah, so obviously you want to address and treat the cause primarily, be it multilobar pneumonia. You've, of course, you're going to start antibiotics and fluid resuscitate the patient. If it's ARDS, you want to treat the cause of the ARDS, if it's shock or whatever other cause. But you also have to consider other potential causes like massive PE. And so when I'm approaching the patient who I've intubated and have on 100% oxygen, what I think about first is I got to look at the chest x-ray, because that is going to sort of guide my response and my ventilator management for this patient, and really guide the overall management for this patient. So there's sort of three options in terms of the hypoxic intubated patient on 100% oxygen. The three options in terms of the chest x-ray. I'll start with the first option, which is if you see a normal or, let's say, a very mildly abnormal chest x-ray. Really, in that setting, there's a very limited differential, and it really comes down to two options. It's either going to be a massive PE or right-to-left shunt, and you would presumably know if a patient has a congenital heart defect or some other right-to-left shunt pre-existing, such that that really becomes very rare. And in the setting of a normal chest x-ray and severe hypoxia on 100%, you really got to be thinking that this is a massive PE, and you got to direct your efforts in that regard. So what do I do for that patient? You know, I start by getting a bedside echo, start looking for signs of that PE on ultrasound, things like right heart strain, dilatation of the right side of the heart, bowing of the right ventricle into the left ventricle. Sometimes you can even see the clot on the ultrasound. I do an echo. I often will, in these cases, treat presumptively with thrombolytics. If I see findings on echo that are suggestive of massive PE, I want to get that going right away. And one of the important points here is that whereas in other types of extreme hypoxemia on 100% oxygen, like ARDS, in which you would use PEEP, this is a scenario in which you really don't want to use PEEP. It could be disastrous. You could further impede filling of the heart, and you could put the patient back into shock. So my first move, again, my first consideration in this type of patient, again, we're talking about the hypoxic patient on 100% oxygen who's intubated, is to look at that chest x-ray and go from there.
Rob, I'm interested in, you know, I think this is a great initial approach. And you mentioned something really, really important, which is the bedside echo. And one of the things with right to left shunt that you can often see with really a simple test is a bedside bubble study. And have any of you guys done this on a regular basis or done this before?
Yes.
Yeah, it's super easy, super helpful. You just take basically a 10cc syringe, empty out an ml of saline, shake it up, and then these right to left shunts sometimes that open up, even if it's just from massive pulmonary hypertension or some other problem, you can kind of tell pretty quickly whether it's an intracardiac shunt or an intrapulmonary shunt. What was taught to me during fellowship was clearly you can see the PFO or the bubbles move over from right to left pretty quickly if it's intracardiac, but takes about 3 to 4 cardiac cycles or beats for the bubbles to move. You can sometimes diagnose a intrapulmonary shunt, or basically that there's a vascular malformation in the pulmonary tree. So spot on with the bedside echo. And I would just add the addition of bedside bubble studies, easy to do and can sometimes take some other differentials off the table.
I like that. That's a great pointer.
Rob, this is a super helpful approach. Start by looking at the x-ray. If it's normal, really consider two things, massive PE or right to left shunt, use bedside echo, and then consider thrombolytics in the patient who you suspect massive PE. Peter, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. It's not a normal chest x-ray. In fact, this time, patient has diffuse bilateral interstitial infiltrates. We're thinking they may be developing ARDS in the ED. Sats are poor, despite 100% FiO2. Take us through this case.
Yeah, so in this case, what I call the whited out chest x-ray, right? There's more white than there is black on it. So precious few alveoli to do our gas exchange. We want to first think about simple things that we can do to lower demand on the patient's part. So in fact, if the patient's febrile, we want to reduce that fever, and that will, again, reduce the oxygen requirements. If the patient's agitated, or even if they're not agitated, we want to start with a sedative and then strongly consider paralyzing the patient. The whole goal there is to lower the demand and to improve the patient ventilator synchrony. And that's really something that we should be considering. Other things that we can consider are things such as IV prostacyclin. We can also consider one of the things that we do in our ICU on a frequent basis for these patients, which is prone positioning. And again, we don't move to prone positioning for these patients without sedatives and paralytics on board, and then have a whole team designed to help flip the patient. This can improve oxygenation for 24 to 48 hours. So it is a go-to thing and something that we've toyed with in the emergency department as well. When we talk about PEEP, this works by multiple mechanisms, and this can be everything from recruitment of collapsed or sick alveoli or improvements in VQ mismatch. And again, it can prevent further lung injury from rapid recruitment, opening and closing of alveoli, and really creating a shear factor over the alveolus, which can lead to worsening leak and worsening ARDS. When we're talking about PEEP, we want to start really in these patients with the whited out chest x-rays. We're not starting at 5 of PEEP. We're starting right away with 10 to 12 of PEEP, and then we're going to titrate that up. There's something called the PEEP recruitment maneuver. And again, this is the ramp up of the PEEP to approximately 35 or even higher. Some people use 40 to 50, and they do this for only a minute. And then they come back down to a PEEP level somewhere between 20 and 25. And again, that's a PEEP recruitment maneuver. This maneuver was formally recommended in refractory hypoxia.
So let me just ask a few follow-up questions in terms of these patients. Paralyzing the patient, what are you using in terms of that to ensure better patient ventilator synchrony? Would you first advocate being aggressive with the analgesics and sedation, and then if still the patient is dysynchronous, then moving to paralytics? Or would you, in this particular scenario, move to paralytics earlier? And would you also consider a continuous infusion or intermittent bolus dosing?
So in my shop, what we would do, you know, I hate to say it depends, but if we're just on the cusp, then we'll go with sedation. If you're severely hypoxic and I need your synchrony right now, or we're going to be in big trouble, I'll go ahead and paralyze you straight out and then have a constant infusion and then have holidays during that period, kind of wake you up as many as 3 times in a 24-hour period to have you back, as long as it wasn't causing a calamity with profound hypoxemia.
So Rob, let me turn to you. Peter mentioned PEEP recruitment maneuver and taking patients up to very high levels of PEEP, much higher than we're used to, for a brief period of time and then backing off. There's a new study out there that may question this practice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I personally used to use PEEP recruitment maneuvers pretty frequently in this scenario. And this study just came out in JAMA. It's by Cavalcanti and others. And it was a very large study conducted in 120 ICUs from 9 different countries. And they enrolled a total of 1,010 patients. And they randomized severely hypoxic ARDS patients to usual care, usual sort of ARDS care, ARDS vent settings with recruitment maneuvers performed versus usual care and no recruitment maneuvers. And the results were pretty striking. They basically found an increased mortality in the recruitment maneuvers arm of things. They had higher 28-day mortality, 55.3% versus 49.3%. And they had higher 6-month mortality at 65.3% versus 59.9%. And so the conclusions from these authors were that in a strategy with using lung recruitment maneuvers compared to standard PEEP or lower dose PEEP was associated with increased 28-day all-cause mortality. And so they do not support the use of routine lung recruitment maneuvers in these patients. I would dare say kind of a landmark study in suggesting that we should probably not routinely use these recruitment maneuvers.
So very, very important piece of literature. Now, John, I'm going to go to you for the final case in terms of chest x-ray, but any thoughts on what we've talked about for this patient with ARDS, the whiteout lung, as Peter refers to, and then this latest study in JAMA that appears to be practice-changing article?
Yeah, Mike, I agree with everyone that this is a really interesting study. And I think that it goes to show that, you know, these short-term interventions really don't fix the problem. And oftentimes it's patient positioning. Proning truly is the treatment for ARDS. And so if you're not at a center that can do this, thinking about getting your patient to a primary referral center for ARDS patients who is comfortable doing more aggressive treatments such as proning or even VV ECMO might be the way to go. We've talked in the past about the use of driving pressure and how sometimes increased PEEP is just increased PEEP. And it can put a lot of strain on the right ventricle itself and could potentially, I suppose, even cause additional ventilator-associated lung injury, depending on how it's done. So it's hard to say exactly why mortality was increased with the study, but there was a clear effect. So definitely something I'll think twice about using on a routine basis.
Peter, anything to add on this latest study?
No, again, changes what we do, what we teach, and makes us real cautious with pushing up to higher levels of PEEP, even for short periods of time.
All right, so patient's hypoxic, they're on the ventilator despite maximal FiO2. If they've got a normal chest x-ray or slightly abnormal, I'm thinking PE or shunt. In terms of the whiteout, the bilateral interstitial infiltrates, certainly starting off with higher PEEP and titrating up but not utilization of a recruitment maneuver. Paralysis followed by prone positioning if we have that capability. What about the one case that's kind of in between, John? So they don't have whiteout, it's not normal, but perhaps they've got a unilateral infiltrate, unilateral pneumonia, and they have this profound hypoxemia. Take us through that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this patient's slightly different, especially when you have a single lung whiteout. And the first thing I'm thinking is mucus plug or some sort of foreign body that's either obstructing the entire lung or the lobe. And so if I'm in the ICU or even not, a call for early bronchoscopy is something that's not unreasonable. And in the meantime, just aggressive suctioning to try and remove the potential obstruction can sometimes get you out of the woods. Now, if you do try that in the this truly is a pure aggressive lobar or even unilateral pneumonia. We were talking a little bit about proning. Well, the nice thing is you can actually do something similar for this patient and think about putting a wedge so that the good side of the lung is actually down. What you do in this case is so you have the bad lung on the upside and the good lung in the dependent side, so closer to the bed. And what this does is it kind of pushes the blood flow down towards the good lung so you can have better gas exchange. Rather than doing a full prone positioning, because it's not diffuse bilateral infiltrates, it's unilateral, you just kind of tilt them a little bit. So usually I'll put a wedge to about like 45 degrees and have the good lung closer to the ground. Now, the addition of PEEP may be helpful, but I wouldn't be surprised if it actually makes things worse, because one of the challenges here is that every time you deliver a positive pressure breath, the natural flow of the air that's coming out of the ventilator is going to go towards the good lung because the resistance is less. And so sometimes you can get into some trouble with hyperinflation and can really disturb your VQ mismatch even a little bit more by over-distending those alveoli in the good lung. So if you're working really with like a single lung ventilation model, definitely being considerate of your tidal volumes and your PEEP and patient positioning are going to be the three things that I'm thinking about after I've aggressively suctioned to make sure that there's nothing obstructive that I can get to right away.
That's outstanding, John. Rob and Peter, do you have anything to add to this particular case scenario?
Yeah, I would just make sure that that whited out lung is not hemoptysis and not bleeding lung, because in that case, it makes it even dicier, because if you're putting the good lung down and you may get spillage over to that lung as well. So you need to be cautious. I really do like what John said, though, about being mindful about both pressure, PEEP, as well as volume, our tidal volume choices, and making sure that we're not going to over-distend healthy lung units and, in fact, de-recruit them. So just be cautious with that. So it's a great point that John brings up there.
And one more thing that I've actually, and it's embarrassing to say, I've been fooled on in the past, is when you intubate the patient, you go on and do a bronchoscopy and the lung's completely clean. And as soon as you do that, you recognize, oh, I'm such a fool. In fact, it was a big pleural effusion rather than an actual intrapulmonary process. So a quick lung ultrasound can definitely take that off the table pretty quickly. And in some cases, spare you the intubation, because once you decompress them, all of a sudden things go back to normal.
Once again, the utility of ultrasound. Rob, do you have anything that you want to add in terms of the points for patients with a unilateral infiltrate or one lung down and refractory hypoxemia?
No, I think they hit on all the really strong points there. Again, you definitely need to rule out effusion, and that's so easy to do these days. It really should be a reflex to pop your ultrasound in there. Your ultrasound can also, even if it's not effusion, it can give you some idea of what's going on in the parenchyma of the lung. If it's so socked in like that, you certainly could see changes on ultrasound as well. And as Peter mentioned, really got to make sure that this is not a pulmonary hemorrhage scenario in which you might make things worse. But I do this all the time, and I use positioning, as everybody has mentioned, really a principle of prone positioning and just sort of semi-prone. And I adjust patients' positioning 2 or 3 times a day when I have them in the ICU.
Well, great, great pointers. I'm just going to point out one more thing before we wrap up, and that's the use of VV ECMO. I think, John, you had mentioned this in terms of potential therapy. And I would say in publications, it's usually listed under the salvage or rescue therapy. And I have to say, as more and more centers get facile with ECMO, I'm not really sure it's salvage therapy. I think it's considered early on now in the care of many of these patients who have this refractory hypoxemia or hypoxia. We have an actual dedicated lung resuscitation unit at the University of Maryland where lots and lots of patients go on VV ECMO. And I think that certainly as we now are approaching flu season, we can expect to see an uptick in these type of patients. And so what we've gone through here has been exceedingly helpful, especially for the emergency physician who's got that ICU border. They've intubated. They're starting off with the Ventilator, the mat, past several years here on the podcast. But what do you do when the patient's sats are dropping or you intubate them and you simply can't get the oxygen saturations up? And Rob, I really, really like this approach of basing it on the X-ray. Is it normal? Thinking about only a few things. Is it diffuse bilateral? And we've talked about a few pearls in that in terms of that management. And then what if it's primarily one lung involved? And we just went through some key pearls. Any final thoughts, John, Rob, and then Peter?
No, this is, as you mentioned, we're definitely getting close to flu season. So I think, you know, the key point that I took away, and thanks to Rob for bringing this to my attention, is this new trial of routine use of PEEP recruitment maneuvers. I'm going to definitely focus on my bread and butter of low tidal volume ventilation and PEEP optimization, but might be leaning a little bit less on my recruitment maneuver.
Rob, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think my one final thought is that all of these patients need to be really, as Peter mentioned, heavily sedated. And really pretty much every patient like this should be paralyzed for a while, at least until you kind of get a handle on the situation. So when I'm faced with this scenario that they're intubated and I have them 100%, even as I'm, let's say, increasing the PEEP and ARDS, I'm really going to reach for that Vecuronium or another paralytic. I think that you really need to take control of the situation. And as long as you are attentive later on to the issue of prolonged paralysis by paralytic holidays and or use of a twitch monitor, you're going to be okay. So I'm pretty rapidly paralyzing these patients.
Peter, bring us home.
Yeah, this is a great logical approach to the hypoxic patient. And again, I would just, you know, echo what's been said by John and Rob. But again, there tends to be a hesitancy to move these patients. And I think that we were very clear in stating how you can have some benefits, not just from proning, but also if a unilateral process is going down, making sure that the good side is down. And just remind our listeners about that.
This has been super helpful discussion, gentlemen. I want to thank all of you. Rob, thanks for bringing this topic up and certainly highlighting the latest groundbreaking literature. And as always, Anybody who has any questions for us in terms of this particular topic, anything we've talked about during this podcast, please shoot us an email and we'll get you a response. Since we're a little bit long, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. But one last note, it is not too late for Critical Points in December in San Diego. You have a few weeks left to join an amazing crew out there and just fantastic, wonderful way to end 2017 with a great, great CME conference, Critical Points in San Diego. And you can link to that off our homepage on the podcast website. This is Mike Winters once again from the University of Maryland. We will talk to you on our next podcast.